But in the final analysis, as the old centrist establishment candidates from both sides, Republican and Democrat, that we, those are our choices.
The reason for that is that only the centrist candidates can appeal to those individuals because they are the ones who have the organization, who are willing to be responsive to the interests.
Who are safe.
They're safe, that's right. And the ones who can, who are trusted by those interests.
We were talking about the issues that are not being discussed. I just happened to think of the most, perhaps the most momentous, and that's the savings and loan crisis.
Well, there's kind of a Democratic and Republican gentleman's agreement, if you will, not to discuss this because there are fingerprints from both parties on that scandal. It's one of the most outrageous events to occur in the history of American government. It's the biggest taxpayer ripoff of all time. It's a shame and a stain on the government, and they're not likely to want to discuss it because there's no way to lay that blame at any feet other than their own collectively. But even those who are drawn to Governor Clinton, and he's leading in the polls and has been for the period after Labor Day routinely, even that group is still not overly enamored of Governor Clinton, still doubtful about either candidate's willingness to truly tackle these issues, and think the country's headed in the wrong direction, and are disaffected. That remains.
We talk with a man who's made a study of voter apathy, disgust, and alienation, and what is happening in the 92 election right now on Alternative Views.
As the 1992 election approaches, we will discuss its significance with Professor Bruce Buchanan of the University of Texas Government Department. Bruce is author of a book, Electing a President, on the 1988 election, and today we want to discuss with him the events so far in the 1992 election, to what extent his analysis of the 1988 election illuminates the unfolding of the election so far. And most important, what can be done to have more democratic and meaningful presidential elections in the future?
Bruce, this seems to be kind of a strange election in some ways. What do you consider the key events so far, or are there any?
Well, I suppose that the most unusual event of this election is the present Senator Ross Perot and all that he represents, the disaffection on the part of the electorate. The unhappiness with the failure of the government to address big problems like the budget deficit. That in itself is unusual. Another unusual feature is the presence on the Democratic ticket of not only an outsider, but a very competent, politically competent outsider, at a time when the heavyweights of the Democratic Party had decided to opt out, expecting President Bush to be all but unbeatable.
In fact, let's go into this issue of how Clinton was able to win so easily the Democratic primary. He was a governor from one of the smallest states in the country. He wasn't particularly well known before the election. There were some major Democratic senators in the race, and yet Clinton pulled out ahead and breezed into home. How did this happen?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One, Mr. Clinton and his organization targeted the Florida Democratic caucuses, which were the first organized Democratic Party events of the election season, and managed to win that and attract an unusual amount of media attention because of it. That was the first thing. Second thing was the extraordinary organization that he had put together before those Florida caucuses. In some senses, Bill Clinton's been running for president since he was 12 years old, and I think that's come out this election season. And he was ready for that, hit the ground running, as it were, and showed in primary after primary that he could take a hit, that he would not give up or grow disheartened, would not drop out. And then the final, and perhaps in some respects the most important thing, was how well-financed he was, especially in that critical early period, so that he was able to mobilize media and attract attention that put him out ahead of his competitors.
And who was financing Clinton and why? What interests were behind and are behind his campaign?
Well, in the early going, most of his financing was drawn from the state of Arkansas, surprisingly. He had people down there who had confidence in him, who realized that this was the bionic candidate and that he was one of the best prepared young men in the United States on the issues.
Now, this is Mr. Stevens, the big financier and banker from Little Rock, right?
That's one of the bankrollers. And
who also supported Bush the time before.
That's right. And you could say the same thing about Sam Walton, another financial angel who was known to contribute to both sides as well. But that money got him started, and then he attracted the attention of the party and the money managers in the party after that Florida primary. And went up and down. When he took his hits from Paul Tsongas in New Hampshire, the money dried up for a time until he showed his ability to come back. And that's really the thing that disheartened his competitors. They thought they had put him out of the race in New Hampshire because of the
Jennifer Flowers
affair, and particularly that. And I think it was a distant second place finish, or maybe even a third place finish. I've forgotten now. But anyway, they thought he was over, but he just kept on ticking, did not give up. Rebounded from that and did better when the campaign had headed south. As you recall, he won in Florida, beat Paul Tsongas there, and the rest is history.
So big money just wants to back a winner.
Big money
they
backs the winner.
They saw Clinton as a potential winner, and so they got on board hoping to get favors later.
That's exactly what's happening now.
Plus he was saying things that they like to hear. Unlike Jerry Brown or previous election Jesse Jackson.
Well, they saw him, the money interests saw Mr. Clinton as more likely to be responsive to their interests if elected than either of the others, either Tsongas or Brown or Kerry or the senator from Iowa.
You mentioned Perot. This is a curious election because not only Perot, but also Buchanan and also Jerry Brown. They were all talking, trying to tap the other 50% that didn't vote, the people who were disaffected, and this seemed to be quite successful for a while.
Well, I think when you take the results that each of those three men generated and aggregate them together, you come up with anywhere from a third to a half of the potential electorate, depending on how you slice it and when you ask the question. The interesting thing about that phenomenon is just how widespread and varied is that disaffection, and those men showed it.
What's really amazing to me is that, particularly with Perot really wasn't saying anything, but he was a man who was out there and had the money, and people flocked to him not even knowing what he was like.
Well, that's true, and I think that the reason for that initially had to do with the fact that here was somebody who couldn't be bought, who had nothing personal to gain, and who seemed to have no reason to seek the presidency other than a desire, as he said, to serve the people. He called the American people the owners of the system, and he said he was there at their behest to serve them.
But Perot was also articulating very radical critiques of the political system, the fact that politics as usual wasn't working, the fact that the political parties were not really meeting the needs of the people. And that was likewise Jerry Brown's message, who was attacking the corruption of the process, and Pat Buchanan was making radical statements attacking Bush and attacking the political establishment, and also making radical critiques of the political establishment of politics as usual. And so you had three people out there who were really making the most radical critiques of the system that one had heard for years in the mainstream media.
No question about that. And one of those three looked like he had a serious chance to win.
Which was Perot, who seemed to be articulating the alienation and the dissatisfaction of the people with politics as usual. And as Frank said, even though he didn't articulate a positive program, it was just his anti-establishment posture and just his offering an alternative to politics as usual that seemed to be his attraction, which to me signifies a very deep alienation
I think you're right
about
that.
Of the electorate from the electoral politics.
I think you're right about that. There was, he, as you know, he came out with a program only after he withdrew from the race,
right.
And which makes him interesting. And the effect of that program lingers on. But there was the fact that he couldn't be bought, as that I mentioned earlier. And the other fact was that here was a man who had made something of himself, who had shown the ability to manage large enterprises, who looked like he might be able to make something happen in Washington.
Does it seem unusual, or does it seem business as usual, the fact that in the last election we had Jesse Jackson, who had a radical critique. This time we had these people we're talking about. But in the final analysis, it's the old centrist establishment candidates from both sides, Republican and Democrat, those are our choices.
And I think that has to do with the role of money in politics primarily. I think that the reason for that is that only the centrist candidates can appeal to those individuals because they are the ones who have the organization, who are willing to be responsive to the interests.
We're safe.
They're safe, that's right. And the ones who are trusted by those interests. And that's something that needs to be addressed in some way, I think.
You know, I see that, to me, there's less difference between Clinton and Bush than there was between Dukakis and Bush, or between Reagan and, who was that, Walter Mundine?
Right.
I mean, Clinton is anti-Cuba, is for putting the most stringent types of restrictions on Cuba. He's pro-Contra. So it's against the Nicaraguans, and whereas most of or many of the Democrats were against the Contras, he is for workfare. It almost sounds like a Republican platform, except that he's talking about the economy more.
Well, he does come out of that Democratic Leadership Council, which was an effort to push the Democratic Party back toward the center and to espouse the kind of conservative economic message in particular that could attract enough votes to be competitive with a more successful Republican Party. So there's some truth to that. Having said that, I would still argue that Clinton talks a collection of policies that sound like they would depart from what we've grown accustomed to under Republican leadership. Mm-hmm. He views the state as a positive thing rather than as the problem. At least he speaks that way.
Which is what Bush has been attacking the
That's
last
right.
few days.
That's
that
right.
He's a big welfare state, sort of social Democrat in
That's
Bush's...
Right.
current line.
That is what Bush hopes to hoist him on, that particular petard. Mr. Clinton does seem to regard the state positively. He does want the government involved in trying to deal with problems that Bush would leave to the marketplace. Where the problem enters is in what happens when Mr. Clinton is elected, if he is, and confronts a Congress that is beholden to the same interest and is pressured to compromise, and one wonders then whether any movement off the status quo dead center can result, despite the policy differences, the real policy differences that we hear about in the campaign.
Bruce, let's talk now about how Clinton pulled ahead suddenly in the polls and the role of the polls in the election so far. When I left to go to Asia, Perot was ahead. Bush was closely behind, second. Clinton was third.
And when was that?
This was in July, of the middle of the summer of 1992, and it looks like Clinton's campaign had collapsed. He was a distant third in the polls. Bush and Perot were bashing each other ferociously, and Perot was actually ahead in early July and then started to come down as the month went on, and then suddenly dropped out, and then suddenly Clinton popped ahead 10 points, which meant that Perot's voters must have gone over to Clinton. Something happened to turn things around. So how do you appraise Perot's dropping out and how it benefited Clinton?
Well, I think that's the signal event. What I think drove Perot out of the race was the fact that the Republicans mounted an effective negative or attack campaign against Perot that started to erode his standing. And Perot began to confront the fact that this might not necessarily be something that was enjoyable to do.
In fact, it hurt his
that's
feelings.
That's a paraphrase. It hurt his feelings. And he could see that this was no picnic he was about to enter into, and so he decided he could be more effective on the outside, leaving all those voters with this choice: to return to the status quo president, President Bush, the man that they sought to evade or avoid by going to Perot in the first place, or to take another look at this third place contestant, who would at least, whatever shortcomings that they might see in him, be an alternative to Bush. So that got Clinton his second look. That gave him a bounce that took him to his convention, and then he confronted the next big question. Can he pull this party together? Can he present a credible front? And indeed, that was the excuse that Perot used for dropping out, that yes, Mr. Clinton can be credible.
He picked a good vice president, Al Gore, who seemed to be a popular choice. Everyone in the Democratic Party seemed to pull together at the convention. Jackson didn't bolt. Brown didn't bolt. There was a united front that the Democrats had, and that Clinton looked like a winner.
He did.
Coming out of the campaign, out of the convention, and so you think Perot just decided to chuck it in.
He decided that at that point as he put it then, he didn't think he could win. He could only force it into the House of Representatives, which he didn't want to do. Others suggest that it had more to do with his lack of stomach for the contest, and that probably played some part in it. But anyway, this was Clinton's opportunity, and he made the most of it. Right after the convention, of course, he mounts these famous bus tours, which generate a lot of media attention, and begin to increase the uncertain people who were evaluating him after abandoning Mr. Perot. Then, of course, the economic news continued to be bad, and that reinforced these trends.
Your book and the studies you made before have a lot to do with polls. Do you find that the Clinton and the other news about how the rich raped the poor during the Reagan-Bush years and this tremendous transfer of wealth from the poor and the middle class back to the rich and the impoverishment of the middle class, almost destruction of it, do you find this is playing well in the polls, or even they're even talking about it? This is one thing that Clinton does seem to mention about fairly consistently, but you don't hear the press talking about it as much as his draft status.
Well, the press talks about the horse race and the feeding frenzy of the moment, the draft status, or pictures, polls, attacks, and mistakes tend to be their preoccupation. There is considerable attention by the candidate, Governor Clinton, to this matter. He talks about the negative effects of trickle-down economics and how that didn't work. Now it's time to try something else. The recession has made people alarmed about their prospects, and that makes them receptive to messages coming out of the 80s which show the gap in income between the middle class and the beneficiaries of Reaganomics to be growing in alarming ways. They're paying attention to that now as the economy worsens in ways that seem less relevant when people were not fearful for their jobs.
But I've noticed something, that when Harkin and Brown were saying these same things, the media were calling them, you're fomenting class warfare.
Class warfare. Well,
now the Clintons. No, I mean, even on NPR and the TV network announcers and they were really harping on this theme. But now the Clintons are saying that we don't hear that statement anymore.
Don't hear it so much anymore, and I think that tells you something about how the press may follow the polls like the Supreme Court follows the elections.
Bruce, let's reflect now on why Bush is doing so poorly. Obviously, one of the facts is the economy. The economy has not been good for many years, and Reaganomics created very serious problems for the economy as a whole. The deficits, the joblessness, the homelessness, the increased poverty, the gaps between rich and poor. But this isn't the whole story of why the electorate has turned off Bush. People just simply don't like him. They see him as someone more concerned about foreign affairs rather than domestic affairs, someone who doesn't care about the problems of ordinary people. And he seems to have really collapsed in his standing after the Gulf War, when he had the highest rating in history, 90% approval, and everyone thought he was a sure thing to be reelected. And everyone was looking, at least the majority of the electorate, very positively on Bush. Whereas now it seems people are deeply alienated for Bush. He has simply not been able to ignite any support. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for that, too. One would be the fact that Mr. Bush wasn't prepared for the situation he finds himself in, and he doesn't have a repertoire for addressing it. Republicans are accustomed to running at times and in ways that allow them to set the agenda through their advertising or through their efforts to exert what we think of as or call spin control. That isn't working now. We saw that as a consequence of the Republican convention, where they tried to establish family values as the agenda in an effort to change the subject from the economy, and that didn't play. And they're in disarray now. They don't know what to do. They're fighting about how best to approach their situation. George Bush is a man who has never enjoyed campaigning and whose instincts told him that this would be something of a cakewalk, who now finds himself in a deep hole with mixed advice and kind of at loose ends. He hasn't figured out what to do, how to respond.
Getting a little late, isn't it?
It is late. Right now, he's in a position, as we approach the election, of being further behind than anyone who ever went on to win in recent times has been.
What might turn it around for Bush?
It seems to me that there are a couple of scenarios that might do that. One would be the emergence of some international problem or crisis that would enable him to display Persian Gulf-style leadership again. That would be one possibility. Another possibility would be a revelation damaging to the governor of Arkansas. And there's that can't ever be ruled out, of course. But barring something like that, the problems that Bush confronts in terms of coming from this far back in such a short time, and the fact that the economic news is not going to turn better in time to bail him out, it looks like Clinton's to lose.
We noticed in the last election that there were some momentous stories which the Democrats now try to use. That was, for one, the October surprise story, where the Reagan-Bush campaign against Carter arranged to have the hostages held in the embassy in Iran in exchange for later shipments of arms, which was just part of a massive covert action against the Carter administration by the Reagan, pure treason. But Dukakis didn't use it. The other thing was the massive illegal arms and drug operations, which were run out of George Bush's office, and with Oliver North next door, later running a parallel operation. All of these things were covered in the alternative press and to some degree in the establishment press, and you even had some indication that ABC ran some things for a few days on it. But the Democrats didn't use those. Momentous stories, incredible stories, and Clinton didn't use those this time. Right. Why do you suppose?
Well, I think it's because he doesn't feel he needs to at this time. I assure you that if he ever felt the need to, i.e., if the polls started to close and if his candidacy got in trouble or if he suddenly were hurt by a story like the draft story, then you would start to hear about the Republican position on abortion. Then you would start to hear about the Iran-Contra affair and the president's invasion of that. Mr. Clinton showed in the Democratic primary against Paul Tsongas in Florida that he was not above using attack advertising to discredit an opponent, effectively cutting Paul Tsongas off at the knees by scaring the elderly in Florida about Mr. Tsongas's position with respect to Social Security. He wouldn't hesitate for a moment to use any of the things you mentioned if he felt he had to. He doesn't think he has to.
Actually, they have each other checkmated on the issue of character and their past. If the Bush campaign goes too much into Jennifer Flowers and Clinton's affairs, then there's a whole line of Bush mistresses that could be brought out of the closet, which have actually been discussed to some extent in this campaign already, yes. Whereas that was another thing that just wasn't mentioned in 1988. Then secondly, if the Bush administration goes too hard against Clinton in the draft or some skeleton he might have that raises character issues, they have Iran-Contra, where Weinberger and Shultz came out, or actually some memos were released in the Iran-Contra investigation that's going on now with Weinberger, that indicated that both Weinberger and Shultz reacted with incredulity to the revelation in 1968 that Bush made to the Washington Post, that he was out of the loop in Iran-Contra discussions. He wasn't at the key meetings. If he'd known the facts about it, he would have opposed it. Whereas both Weinberger and Shultz knew that Bush was at these meetings, he was a supporter of the policy, and that he was lying. And that's a more serious, I think, character issue than whatever Clinton might have done to get out of the draft. So I think they're both pretty uneasy about bringing these kinds of character issues into the campaign. And if one side tries, the other's going to come back pretty hard and fast.
The irony there might be that two vulnerable candidates are forced to deal with issues in spite of themselves.
Right.
Bruce, in your book, you deal a lot with people's attitudes and the effect of advertising, political advertising, and particularly the so-called negative advertising or attack advertising. I'm a bit uncomfortable. Isn't there a difference between so-called dirty tricks advertising or attack advertising, negative advertising, and actually pointing out problems with policies, problems with character, which people should know about? There should be negative campaigning to inform the people of the negative things and the bad things about the people involved in campaigns, shouldn't they?
That's absolutely true.
So where's the line drawn?
Well, it seems to me the line is drawn in the context of a balanced presentation by a candidate. The preponderant message by any reasonable construction of Democratic good practice is that the majority of the message is about what the candidate will do if elected. And some minority portion of the presentation can legitimately deal with the flaws of the other side, as long as those flaws are relevant to that person's ability to lead. The problem arises when something is taken out of context that is of questionable relevance to the leadership capacity of the opposition, and then hammered on to such a degree that it distorts the discourse of the campaign away from the public's agenda solely onto some agenda that favors the electoral prospects of the perpetrator. That's where I would draw the line and how I would draw it. And the example that comes to mind, of course, is the hammering on an issue like the cleanliness of Boston Harbor, which is of dubious relevance to Michael Dukakis's leadership capacity, or the presence or absence of support for the Pledge of Allegiance recitation in classrooms.
Or the Willie Horton furlough
issue. These things are...
30 or so governors had this.
That's right.
Policy.
That's right.
The governor before Dukakis actually instituted it.
And so the line is a willingness to take an isolated instance like that that might deserve a passing mention and turn it into the central event of a campaign. And that's what was wrong, I think, with 1988.
And yet the media do not critique these things. They just swallow them or just repeat them. Being objective, all they do is just repeat what somebody else has told them or just run the ads and not provide an analysis of those.
Well, that was true in 1988 in particular. But the media took the pledge after that because they were sensitive to that criticism, and they have attempted to compensate for some of those shortcomings. We saw a significant increase in the 1990 midterm elections in truth testing, both in newspapers and on television. One of the stations in the city that we're filming was a pioneer at that. A local ABC affiliate led the way on that score. And in the 92 election, we're seeing a good deal more of that as well, people paying more attention to the veracity of advertising. But as this is taped, we have not yet seen the beginning of the full-fledged advertising campaign.
Yeah.
So the jury's still out on whether the media steps up to the plate on this.
There's
issue.
There's another issue that you mentioned in your book, and I also mentioned in my book, Television and the Crisis of Democracy, concerning the 1988 election, and that is the extent to which it was reduced to sound bites, where you got very small snippets of the speeches of the day. It was mostly the photo opportunity, pictures, images of the campaigners on the election trail, rather than any substantive remarks or analyses or even presentations of their position. And this year, the networks, particularly CBS, pledged that it wasn't going to have such small sound bites. But yet, a couple analyses have come in the last couple of weeks. One was published in the New York Times, another in the Political Hotline newsletter, that indicated that it's business as usual, that it's still the same 8 or 9 second sound bite. In fact, I think it was ABC. The average sound bite for Clinton was 5.2 seconds, and Bush 11.9, which is giving him twice as much. And I think it was CBS had 11.4 for Bush and 8.6 for Clinton. So again, these are very small sound bites. So the media has not improved in that.
In that
issue.
Score, at least. I think you're right about that. And they're finding it very difficult to resist what they perceive as intense market pressure to stay interesting, to move quickly so as not to lose the audience. And I think those pressures are going to stand as inducements away from serving the public interest on this score.
You know, there's something else. We were talking about the issues that are not being discussed. I just happened to think of the most, perhaps the most momentous, and that's the savings and loan crisis. By listening and watching the candidates, you would never know there was such a thing. And yet George Bush was head of the study group, which came out with the way to handle the crisis in the banking industry, and that policy was followed, resulting in the S&L crisis. And yet I haven't heard a thing about that from Clinton.
Well, there's kind of a Democratic and Republican gentleman's agreement, if you will, not to discuss this because there are fingerprints from both parties on that scandal. It's one of the most outrageous events to occur in the history of American government. It's the biggest taxpayer ripoff of all time. It's a shame and a stain on the government, and they're not likely to want to discuss it because there's no way to lay that blame at any feet other than their own collectively. And so that's why they're not discussing it.
This is why someone like Perot is really a threat
right.
to them, because he could say, look how badly they messed things up. There's this SNL scandal. Hundreds of billions of dollars were wasted on this unbelievably stupid program that both the administration and Congress deserve blame
That's
for.
Right.
And then the deficit. The deficit doubling under Reagan, doubling again under Bush, and just no one having any program to control
That's
this.
Right.
And so this was really a year for the outsider because politics as usual has botched things up.
Well, the deficit is the best example of a problem crying out for attention that is not being addressed in this campaign by either major party nominee, either the president or Governor Clinton. And one of the things that Ross Perot did address after leaving the race in the platform that he released to the press, showing the kind of pain that would be necessary to confront that issue.
But none of the three, including Perot, talked about raising the tax bite on the rich back to where it was. They talked about raising it a little bit, but most of it was going to be on the backs of the middle class again.
Well, that falls back on the old presumption, which is at least debatable, that there aren't enough rich to pay all those bills, and so you're going to have to do something like impose Perot's 50% per gallon gasoline tax to get the revenue to truly address that problem.
And yet I've seen figures which show that if the rich were appropriately taxed, it wouldn't take long to pay off the deficit.
Well, if you went back to pre-1986 progressive tax system up in the 75% category, you might be right. But I don't think there's sufficient political support for anybody to push for that at the moment.
Well, this brings up what is probably the greatest distortion by Bush of Clinton's record that I haven't really seen much criticism from the mainstream media, and that is Bush's claim that Clinton raised taxes hundreds of times in Arkansas, that Clinton is just a big taxer. He just can't wait to put all these new taxes on ordinary people, whereas Bush only raised taxes once when he was president. Well, first of all, they grossly distorted Clinton's record as governor. They claimed that things that were taxes were just no ordinary government business things like higher
fee increases and stuff
for prisons, for driver's license, et cetera, et cetera. And it also distorts the fact that Clinton is planning taxes on the upper level, but he is not proposing new taxes for people that make less than $80,000. How do you read this in relation to that issue of truth in campaigning?
Well, it's another example of the kind of distortion that is not unique to either side. Both Republicans and Democrats routinely engage in intense distortion of the truth for self-interested reasons. They continue to do that. This is one of the main problems with campaigns and one of the main things that keeps them from being useful reality checks for voters, keeps them from being relevant or useful to voters who have to assemble the information, make a good choice. And it's deplorable, but we live under a government that elevates the First Amendment, that does not punish or move against that kind of speech. And so until we can convince candidates to take the pledge and reform on their own, we may just have to live with that.
Can we talk now about one of the main things in your book, which is continuing now, and that's the voter alienation?
Yes.
Do you see any turnaround in that? Well, first of all, what are the causes of it?
Well, it seems to me there are three principal causes. One cause is associated with disgust at the style and the results from politics as usual. People in the middle and upper middle classes, the people that I would think of as attentive voters, people who would be there if they had faith in the system, and people who want to be part of the system, are turned off by negative advertising, disgusted by the evasive and distorted quality of political rhetoric, and have simply decided that, given the results this produces, candidates who look alike, who don't get anything done, to simply stay home. And that's one source of declining turnout. Another source of declining turnout is attached particularly to the young, the people in the 18 to 25-year-old age group, who are not being brought into the system through the socialization process. They're not being taught the requirements or the expectations of good citizenship. They're not being imbued with the idea that they own this process and have some responsibility to it, and partly for that reason, and also because as they look at it, it has no relevance to their lives. They're staying away in droves, and voter registration drives with them and Rock the Vote on MTV have yet to produce any significant results. So that's the second source of the estranged or disconnected electorate. And the third has to do with the underclass. And here's a group, a significantly sized group of people in the inner cities, the poor, the dispossessed, the disadvantaged, the black, that are simply so preoccupied with survival in what is indeed a punishing and dangerous subculture that they have no time to even imagine the relevance of politics to their lives. Now, each one of those three categories represents a different kind of voter problem, each of which requires a different solution. So it's a complicated problem. There's no one answer, and it's hard to generalize across the entire electorate.
You know, there's something I've noticed, and when we do programs about this, it opens the eyes of a lot of people. People sense it and feel it when they say, well, no matter whom we vote for, there doesn't seem to be any change, and it seems we vote for this guy, we vote for that guy, we still got Henry Kissinger, et cetera. And by looking at who the big main advisors are and people who hold key positions, in the, particularly in the executive branch, whether it's Republican or Democrat, they all seem to come from that elite eastern area of people who've been running the country for so long, people from the Trilateral Commission, from the Council on Foreign Relations. You look at the people who are secretaries of state, undersecretaries, deputy secretaries, and also in the Treasury and et cetera, CIA. And no matter who is the president, we have the same pot providing the same advisors and same leadership. So I can understand why people will be frustrated when they see that nothing changes, basically.
I think that there's truth to that. There are guilds and networks, issue experts. Even a candidate like Ross Perot found himself drawn to that same group of advisors, mm-hmm. Traditional economists, former members of various administrations. Seems to me, though, that that is less of a problem than the fact that the candidates themselves lack the political courage to bite the bullet. That's one of the things that I, for one, thought Ross Perot might bring to the table this time around. And if the candidate's willing to bite the bullet, then the fact that this advisory talent is the same is less important.
What do you mean by bite the bullet?
Tell the American people, for example, that in addition to this list of goodies that I promise you, you may have to pay some more taxes. Tell the American people that it could be 5 or 7 years before we can expect a significant turnaround. Tell them that that unemployment might have to go higher before it's likely to get better while we retool and retrench. Candidates on both sides routinely suppress that kind of message because they think it's political suicide to present it. And the consequence is that voters are misled as to what the costs and needs are, and are set up by promises of more goodies or something for nothing, in effect.
No new taxes.
That's right. No new taxes or free college tuition or health care or whatever, goodies, programs, which are desirable and need to be there but which have costs. They're led by that to have hope, which then is routinely dashed after Election Day, and that deepens the cynicism and the cycle continues. So you have to deal with that problem of political courage, I think, first, before you can expect voters to come back, advisors to be relevant and useful.
Yeah, what have you found out about the electorate in this election? In the 1988 election, you had a lot of focus group interviews finding out that the alienation was very, very deep. The proof of it, obviously, less than 50% of the registered voters actually voted. And it may be the same low figures this year. Well, what have you discovered with the voters this time around in some of your focus group discussions and research into voters' attitudes and alienation? Is it growing? Is it...
It seems to be deepening, especially after a period of hope represented by these protest candidates that we talked about earlier. I think that their sudden departure from the contest has intensive, you know, raised the frustration level, and that's being visited especially on the president, and that's elevating the prospects of Governor Clinton. But even those who are drawn to Governor Clinton, he's leading in the polls and has been for the period after Labor Day routinely, even that group is still not overly enamored of Governor Clinton, still doubtful about either candidate's willingness to truly tackle these issues, and think the country's headed in the wrong direction, and are disaffected. That remains. That hasn't changed. If anything, it's gotten worse.
Can we look at it from a another level? You remember back in the early 70s when there was this big discussion, not on television so much, but in some of the news magazines and all, about a book from the Trilateral Commission by Samuel Huntington and two other people called The Crisis of Democracy, in which they said that the people had been, one of the problems in the 60s was that the people had been exercising democracy, and it had caused a problem because capitalism and democracy are antithetical. You can't get along. The capitalism cannot exist if there is a healthy democracy where people are demanding their rights and demanding from the system. In fact, I think it was the U.S. News and World Report, they had their headline for their article was "The Democratic Distemper." And from the people in that powerful level up at the Trilateral Commission and all, they and the big capitalists as well, they saw this as a real problem. They didn't want democracy. Do you think? And they wanted the people to be apathetic so they could control the system better. Do you think that this is also going on at the same time?
And have they maybe gone too far, succeeded too well?
Perhaps so. There's long been a strand in what we call sometimes empirical democratic theory that regards apathy as beneficial to democracy because it increases system stability and
right.
because it perpetuates the status quo. And those who have interest in the status quo and who benefit from it tend to be those who take that view and tend to be those who would feel alarm at a sudden upsurge in voter indignation or the mobilization of a mass movement behind an outsider like a Ross Perot. So sure, that kind of thing is threatening indeed.
Well, the U.S. Constitution was made just for this purpose. The framers of it said we got to figure out some type of system so that the masses can't take control and get our property from
this. This goes back to Socrates and Aristotle, as you both well know. So this is an age-old problem of democracy is clearly the only legitimate way to organize and control power, and yet those in the elite categories from time immemorial have felt the need to find ways to sanitize democracy, to limit it, to control it, to restrain it, to keep it from it achieving full flower. And I think that some of the sentiment that you were discussing is in that tradition.
Let's talk about how we might have a more vigorous democracy in the United States, and in particular, how we can have more democratic elections. In the 1988 election, you reflected upon what took place in that election, and you made some recommendations of how there could be more democratic election in the future, having to do with some reforms of making, simplifying voter registration, promoting democracy through educational and television programming, having more debates with more genuine discussion of the issues, making time available to presidential candidates. What is your feeling now about those proposals? Do you think they're still needed and valid to regenerate democracy for the future?
Well, it seems to me that an effort to redress these problems has to approach them or attack them on two fronts.
Okay.
One front is in the short run with specific remedies and new regulations or changes in law like voter registration. But the more enduring problem has to do with the perceptions and attitudes of the voters. Right now, they regard politics at every level as essentially somebody else's business, by other people, for other people. It really doesn't have much to do with their lives or their concerns. As long as that attitude prevails, these other reforms are unlikely to be successful. And so unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because this means that this is a long-term problem, there are no magic bullets or quick fixes. There needs to be a rekindling, a reconstitution of the political grammar in this country, the sense of citizenship, the sense that the people own the process. The only place to start this is with schools and with some of the supplemental education programs that we talk about in there. One of the things, for example, we suggested be done is to use the same technology that the candidates do to introduce into the discourse a voice for the public interest, to use advertising techniques to alert people to the fact that they are the owners and that if they see something they don't like, they can demand that it be changed. But it's going to take a long time. That's the long-term solution. But it's not easy.
I noticed that in your book you didn't mention the possibility of making it easier for a third party to get started and have being able to vote a significant vote for third party candidates. Is this something that's just too unrealistic?
I don't know that it's unrealistic. The problem that I faced and the people that I was working with faced is there are so many problems. You have to focus on the one that you think is the most fundamental and a few related to that. Another thing that we didn't deal with, which is a tremendous problem, is campaign finance. We didn't touch on that at all either. Mm-hmm. But loosening, making it possible for third-party candidates, actually these are related, making financing more readily available or publicly provided would be one way to encourage other voices to be heard in the process.
I like the way the Sandinistas did their first election, which the media didn't report on. They, anybody who had had a group of 20 or more, well, they could form a party and get on the ballot. They had, what, something like seven different parties, and they provided equal representation or equal access to the media. They provided money, equal money for all of them. And, of course, the Sandinistas thought they were going to get about 80-85% of the vote. They only got 67. But that seemed to me a much more fair way of doing it than what we have in the United States.
Well, there's truth in that. Everybody, people who feel strongly in support of the kind of values you just expressed, are simultaneously concerned about what might happen to political stability in this country if we wound up with a multi-party system such as exists in France. And so there's trepidation about how that might play out that keeps well-intentioned people from enthusiastically endorsing that.
In fact, even Benjamin Barber, who has a book called Strong Democracy, that seems to require stronger citizen input and more sources of ideas and debates, he's afraid that cable television, for instance, is going to weaken the cohesiveness of the fabric of society because you hear so many different voices coming up on the cable.
Yes.
That you have a fragmentation of political discourse, and likewise political parties would fragment this. There's others that think that that just creates new openings and room for change that would be beneficial to the system in the long run, and the system itself is dying of its own stagnation. It's sort of winding down through just corruption and inefficiency and the alienation of the people. So if you don't have some changes, I mean, actually, Perot, I think, really reinvigorated the process, brought a lot of people in, showed that a third-party candidate was viable.
Absolutely. I think Perot did show the way, and he will bring a lot of new voices in. And those voices are pressing to get in. And that front is not to be dismissed. It's going to press its way onto the agenda. What I would suggest as a supplement to that is that ways be found to teach the electorate how to use the existing machinery as well, and to mount the effort on that front too. Get them and find a way to get the voice of the public into the discourse. Right now you've got the media, the public, and the candidates. The media and the candidates control the process. The public is supposed to. The media and the candidates are self-interested actors, the one after votes, the other after ratings and sales. There is no voice for the public in this process. There needs to be a credible voice for the public competing as one of three parties in this what is now an electoral triangle. And that could be done through the existing machinery, I think.
Well, how can you do it with the mainstream media when they're keeping out all but the usual suspects as the accredited political speakers. I mean, the public access, for instance, that we have, anyone can make a program and express whatever views they want. So here is a possibility for the public to participate and to speak. But the mainstream media just exclude these kinds of alternative voices.
It seems to me that the only way to get at that is to combine the existing public interest community, which consists of a number of foundations, to create a resource base in advance of a particular election so that they can simply buy the airtime that a major candidate does and force the mainstream media to pay attention to that and to mount a campaign that's just as carefully organized, just as well-staffed, just as well-financed, to put this message on the agenda in a way that can't be ignored. I think that's the way you begin to do that. The problem has been that it's difficult to get the public interest community singing from the same hymn book on this.
In conclusion, what do you see as the future for the United States if we continue this drift of voter alienation and elite control of the electoral system?
Well, our past is the best guide we have to the future. And our past has been to lurch from crisis to crisis so far successfully. We have fiddled while Rome burned before, only at the last minute to galvanize and come together as a people and to move forward and to take some kind of action which regenerates our health and our spirits. And we have to hope that that can happen again. And some such movement as Ross Perot represents may well happen again, because Perot has shown that it's possible, that an outsider can come in and mobilize the resources to take over, that there's an audience for that. And I look for something like that not only to happen again, but perhaps to succeed next time or the time after.
Next on Alternative Views, we have time for some news stories from the Alternative Press.
There was an explosive op-ed piece in the New York Times on August the 31st of this year by the conservative columnist William Safire, alleging high corruption in the Bush administration Department of Justice in the cover-up of the Iraqgate scandal. According to Safire, who again is a conservative Republican, the U.S. Attorney General William Barr, in rejecting the House Judiciary Committee's call for a prosecutor not beholden to the Bush administration to investigate the crimes of Iraqgate, has taken personal charge of the cover-up. Let me explain the Iraqgate scandal and how the Bush administration is covering this up. It's been alleged in the media over the last year that George Bush was the point man for Saddam Hussein and that the U.S. was supporting the military and technological buildup of Iraq since the Reagan administration, and that in particular, the U.S. under Bush's presidency gave $5 billion in industrial credit to Iraq that was administered through an Italian bank in Atlanta, and that this money was used for military purposes, technology, many things other than the food credit for which it was intended, and that Bush administration officials covered this up by falsifying documents, by lying to Congress and the press, and that also the bank that was laundering this money, that was carrying out this aid program, giving money to Iraq, was also involved in all kinds of criminal conduct, and that this was also covered up by the Bush administration. What happened was the Democrats, particularly Jack Brooks and Henry B. Gonzalez, had called for a federal prosecutor to examine the whole history of the Iraqgate scandals, and the Bush Justice Department, with the Attorney General William Barr leading the way, just published a 97-page apology that basically blocked the beginning of developing a special prosecutor to look into this. Well, Safire said that something smells fishy here, and that the Bush Justice Department has a conflict of interest in that they were so heavily involved in this scandal, and that Barr is obviously covering up this scandal for political grounds. Moreover, Safire said that people within the Justice Department say that Barr had removed top
officials who were reassigned so the political appointees would come in that would make sure that the Justice Department didn't investigate this because they were cronies of the Bush administration, and that obviously this cover-up had to do with Bush's reelection. They didn't want all of this information coming out about possible criminal investigation of the Bush administration during the election. Plus, this would highlight the failed Iraq policy of the Bush administration and was thus an embarrassment. Sapphire goes so far as to say that if it turns out that high Bush officials knew about Saddam Hussein's perversion of our agricultural export guarantees to finance his war machine, they could go to jail. That this is a scandal, this cover-up is, again, a tremendous scandal here, and just shows the corruption that's in all aspects of the Bush administration.
The economy is so bad that it's even reached down to the middle class and upper middle class, according to dollars and cents. It's been reported that pawnbrokers have noticed an influx of higher quality items and a shift in clientele from predominantly blue-collar and poorer people to more white-collar customers. The computers, pricey art, antiques, costly jewelry, you can find those at the pawnbrokers now. One client even pawned a Stradivarius violin, so it's even getting tough on the yuppies, it looks like. Okay. Well, here could be a quote of the week, if we ever had the quote of the week, from Lieutenant Colonel General Wellman, who's an ROTC instructor from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, considering the military's ban on gays. He says, "We don't necessarily discriminate. We simply exclude certain types of people." That Orwellian or not? And that brings us to the end of another Alternative Views. We would like to acknowledge the assistance of the people who were a crew for our program. Our supervisor of the people was Brian. Director was Kemma. The camera people, Dinah and Carrie. And our audio person was Ashley.